summarizes them as follows. A, metaphysical, wherein there is absolutely no possibility for the truth of the opposite. Physical and moral, wherein there is a remote possibility for the truth of the contrary, but we have no sufficient reason to think this possibility will be fulfilled in the situation at hand. Now, we would normally call that absolute certainty and moral certainty, but it amounts to the same thing. Metaphysical certainty is absolutely no possibility of the opposite. There's absolutely no possibility of the opposite of I exist. What if I exist? As I can't exist and not exist at the same time. There's absolutely no possibility of the opposite of everything in the universe is either one or many. In a further distinction, Williamson points out that a man can possess intellectual certitude about a proposition and still fail to possess subjective or emotional certitude. The equivalent in our lingo would be, you can have security without having assurance of your salvation. You can be convinced that the Bible teaches that you're saved and eternally secure, but have the emotional insecurity as to whether you're saved. You could lack assurance even though you knew you had security. He can emotionally fear the opposite. You could be fully convinced of the doctrine of eternal security and just wonder whether you're going to go to hell. Just at times have doubts about it. He can emotionally fear the opposite even though he cannot think the opposite to be a possibility. Man can be absolutely certain that God exists and still feel his absence. Fourth, and this is tricky, certitude in error. Is it possible to be certain of things of which you're wrong? To have subjective certitude, feel that you're right, and yet be wrong. St. Thomas even acknowledged that a man may be certain that something is true when in fact he's not. Now, certitude, not certainty, that's objective, certitude of adherence does not belong properly to the act of faith. First, because it also belongs to the intellectual virtues of science, wisdom, and understanding, then because it is common to both true and false faith. For men do not adhere any less firmly to truth than to falsity. That's a very astute observation. In fact, I would like to write a book, probably won't get around to it, right on the tail end of Dave Hunt's book entitled The Reason for the Seduction of Christianity. And the reason for the seduction of Christianity is that we have the wrong kind of epistemology. We have an experiential epistemology rather than a rational epistemology. And Aquinas is hitting at this point right here. Did you ever notice that cults, fanatics, and heretics have just as much certitude about their faith as do the Orthodox? So there is such a thing as certitude in error. However, it should be carefully noted, St. Thomas is not speaking here of intellectual certitude about first principles. About that, there can be no error. But about matters of faith, which are not rationally demonstrable, he is speaking of certitude of adherence or tenacity, not veracity. So you can have a certitude of tenacity without having a certainty of veracity. Nevertheless, St. Thomas does admit that error seems to be even more natural to men as they actually are than knowledge, because men are easily deceived and because the soul is longer in error than in truth during its lifetime. That doesn't sound too much like the guy who started modern humanism, does it? Pretty strong view of depravity. Williamson lists the causes of error as follows. Disease sensation, imperfect sense organ. Incomplete consciousness resulting from lack of union between the intellect and sensation, or burning the candle all night, will produce very similar sensation. The drive of the will toward the good, the necessity to act without compelling evidence in the practical order, these are all the causes of error. Now let's analyze them. Why is it that people come to absolute certitude about things that are wrong? Well, you can have a diseased sensation. You can have an imperfect sense organ and not perceive it correctly and think you're perceiving it correctly. What would be an example of that? color blindness is a good example. You have to have an improper organ for this particular one. I think yours might be another one. An improper organ. Color blindness would be an example. Incomplete consciousness resulting from lack of union between the intellect and the senses.
Mind-body problem.
Your senses sensed it, but the connection between your mind and what your senses sensed is quite loose because of the lack of proper union there. Could be proper sleep, could be proper anything, but your mind, your senses are sensing it right. They're not colorblind. But your mind is not picking up, connecting clearly with what your senses are sensing.
Dyslexia.
Yeah, that kind of thing, sure. That's a mental problem. Dyslexia is a mental problem. You're seeing things in reverse order and so forth. Your senses are picking up right, but your mind is doing it. That would be another example. And the third one, the drive of the will toward the good. How does that do it? The drive of the will toward the good sometimes gets you into error. Your desire gets ahead of your mind. Your will drives toward the good, and you're so zealous to get this that you go in, you allow your mind to make mental errors because your will is too zealous to want to believe it. You want to believe it so badly that you don't think it through as clearly as you should. The necessity to act without compelling evidence in the practical order. Everyday life, you've got to make a million decisions and you can't get absolute proof for them, so you're so accustomed to making decisions built on partial evidence that it's easy to make errors and assume that you've got absolute truth. But whatever the cause of error, it's not a question of error with regard to first principles. You cannot be wrong with regard to first principles once you understand them, once you understand the terms. If you understand what husbands mean and what married men mean, you don't have any choice and you can't be wrong. All husbands are married men.
Are the first principles the only thing concerning which we can have objective certainty?
Or things demonstrable from them. See, you can only have objective certainty, proof, of first principles or things that are logically or rationally, inferentially, irresistibly, whatever you want to say, derived from them.
And I guess at each stage along the game, you have objective certainty.
Well, take a proof for the existence of God. Aquinas believes that every premise is self-evident and the conclusion necessarily follows from the premises. So he believes that the conclusion, God exists, is demonstrated, proven. Now, whether he's right or wrong for now isn't the point. The point is that's what he believes, yes. Assent to certitude is always a conscious process. It is true that Aquinas speaks of an unconscious natural inclination to the truth, but it would seem that, properly speaking, the assent to certitude is a conscious activity for this reason. One can only be certain if he knows the truth is a first principle or reducible to it, which necessitates a rational awareness. Accordingly, Aquinas always makes it a prerequisite of assent that the relationship between subject and predicate be perceived as a necessary one. And this would answer a lot of the objection that's given by modern fideists or coherentists against foundationalism. A principle, a lot of people don't perceive the connection between the subject and the predicate. So you'll get people say, this isn't self-evident to me. That's because you don't perceive the connection. But if you perceive the connection, it would be self-evident to you. So a lot of work has to go in to getting people to perceive the connection between a predicate and a subject in a self-evident statement. They just don't, you know, back to every finite thing has a cause. That is not, on first blush, a self-evident first principle. Every finite thing, because finite and cause just doesn't automatically grab you as all husbands and married men grabs you as self-evident. All husbands and married men grabs you immediately. But every finite thing has a cause doesn't grab you. You have to analyze finite. But once you come to understand that a finite could not be, or could be, but is, and understand that, then you can see it must have been caused to be rather than not be, because it is when it could equally not be. certitude, that subjective certainty, so to speak, certitude is a response, I mean a repose, say that over, certitude is a repose, a resting in, the good possessed. Since certitude involves a conscious assent to the certainty of the truth for which man has an unconscious appetite, then the possession of this truth by the intellect is the reward of certitude. As Regis put it, to reflection, certitude appears as a repose in the possession of this good, a sort of partial beatitude of the intellect caused by the presence of truth, of which nothing in the world could ever deprive it. The reward of the hunger for truth is the meat of certitude, which one consciously enjoys when he perceives the certainty and necessity of the truth possessed. I think that's a beautiful illustration. And it's borne out in your own experience. You labor over a topic, you come to understand the truth in that topic, and you just somehow enjoy that, the intellectual delight of discovery. You just rest in it, you repose in it. The beatific vision will be like that. You've been seeking the absolute good, and then you meet God face to face, and the absolute good fills you. You just rest in it, repose in it, delight in it, enjoy it forever. So in this world, the pursuit of truth gives you little beatific visions, little foretaste of glory divine. When you find one, you got it, you grab a hold of it, you sink your teeth into this steak, this absolute delicious sirloin or prime rib steak. If you didn't have that, what would impel you to learn? I, for the life of me, I can't figure out how anyone who doesn't believe that truth is knowable and can somehow be attained in some degree in this life ever studies anything. Why? Why would you study anything? What are you going to get? What are you looking for? How do you know when you find it? When you find it, how do you know you've got it? And if I were an existentialist like a Sartrean or Camus or one of those, I think I'd commit suicide for that. That doesn't make any sense. And you wonder why so many people are jumping off the cliff. It has a lot to do with the fact that in the modern world you can't be sure of truth or value, and therefore you never have anything to repose in here or to look forward to there. The ontological basis for first principles. And Aquinas has a unique solution to an old problem. And the old problem is, what is the actual basis in reality for first principles? Are they arbitrary? Are they based in reality? If they're based in reality, are we born with first principles? Are they innate? They just bubble up from within? Are we born a blank slate? If so, how could we ever know first principles? If we're born with a whole bubbling store of ideas, how come there's no evidence for that? What is the relationship between first principles and the nature of man? That first principles are based in reality. For Aquinas, it was sufficient that we know being, or that we know being, and that in reality our knowledge of first principles is based on our most fundamental knowledge of being. Thomas saw no need to justify this knowledge any more than one could demonstrate a first principle. Well, let's start there. You can't prove a first principle epistemologically. You just have to see it self-evident. In the ontological realm, that's true as well. The statement, I know being, is a first principle ontologically. I know being. How do you know that is true? How do you know it's a first principle? Just analyze it. Know. Being. What is being? Being is that which is knowable, which is intelligible. I know being. You start unpacking what know means and what being means, and you see that I know being must be true. Or take the undeniable route. I don't know being. A statement is self-defeating. You'd have to know something about being in order to say that you couldn't know anything about being, in which case you do know something about being. So fundamental, he doesn't attempt to prove that you can know reality. That's a fundamental premise you can't deny. If you deny it, you're implying it. If you look at it, you can see it's true. First principles are all reducible to the principle of contradiction. We don't need to go through this. Again, the principle of contradiction is built on the principle that being is not non-being. We don't need to state that again. How we know that first principles are based in reality? Here we've already given the answer to that. We know it because it's undeniable. We know it because it's self-evident. The conclusion is first principles are actually undeniable, whether they're simply in the epistemological realm or the ontological realm. The real question remains to discuss the epistemological origin of first principles. Where do they come from? Am I born with them? Are they written on my mind later? And here is a real dilemma, one of the most important problems in epistemology. Take any first principle, let's use the law of non-contradiction. Where did you get the idea of the law of non-contradiction? Where did it come from? Were you born with it? If you weren't born with it, how could you know it if you weren't already using it? Suppose you were born a blank slate, total tabula rasa, and floating in from somewhere comes the law of non-contradiction. How are you going to recognize it without already having it? You can't recognize it if you don't have it. If you already have it, then you must have been born with it. This is one of the strongest arguments for innate knowledge. On the other hand, if it's innate, if the law of non-contradiction, all these other first principles are innate, then there must be innate ideas. How come we seem to learn all of these? How come everybody doesn't seem to have them innately? What do we do with the empiricist David Hume's arguments that there's no evidence that we have them until we first have some sense experience? What do we do with the basic premise of Aquinas, that all knowledge begins in the senses, that nothing is in the mind which was not first in the senses? To put it internally in terms of Aquinas' system, isn't it contradictory to say that there is nothing in the mind which was not first in the senses, and hold at the same time that there is an innate ability to know first principles? How can you know them without using them? If you're already born with them, then knowledge didn't start in the senses. And it's this dilemma that caused Stuart Hackett, in his otherwise brilliant book, The Resurrection of Theism, to misinterpret Aquinas. He didn't see how Aquinas really reconciled this. And there are a lot of people who think Aquinas is a pure empiricist, like Locke or Berkeley or Hume, and they say he could never have absolute knowledge because he's an empiricist, like Aristotle. Everything begins in the senses. They forget that Aquinas was Aristotelian in his terminology. It was very Augustinian in his theology, and that he did have innate something, we'll get to what, and therefore he could solve the problem. And they miss a whole series of passages in Aquinas where he deals with this very problem. Yes, the Kant's, I should bring my crossroads chart. Kant is the crossroads of modern philosophy, and there are two groups coming into him, the rationalists and the empiricists. The rationalists were people like Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz. The empiricists were people like John Locke, Bishop Berkeley, and David Hume, in that order. Kant died in 1812, just to get some figures in here. Hume died in 1776. The rationalists stressed the innate. They stress what's called the a priori, that we know things independent of experience. The empiricists stressed the blank slate, tabula rasa, and that all knowledge was a posteriori, begins in experience. The rationalist said that you are, your mind is born full, and these empiricists said your mind is empty. And that was a debate that raised until Kant synthesized it. And Kant said, here's the solution to your problem. The rationalists are right with respect to the form of knowledge. The empiricists are right about the content of knowledge. That you are born with an a priori innate form or category, forms of sensation, categories of understanding. But all of the content of your knowledge comes through your senses. You're born with a structure. It's already inbuilt structure. But all the stuff comes from experience over here. And so Kant said, you're both right. The empiricists are right about stuff and content. The rationalists are right about structure and form. And he put it together, and the result was agnosticism, philosophical agnosticism. You can never know what it was before you formed it. All you know is after you form it. You can never know what a thing in itself is. You can only know the thing to you. You don't know the Ding on Zick. You just know the Ding für mich, or something like that. My German pronunciation, not too great, but Kant's English wasn't too good either. So we have a total philosophical agnosticism about ultimate reality built on this ingenious synthesis. He rejected what is called the pre-formation theory. And this is why Stuart Hackett, whom I think is one of the most brilliant evangelical philosophers who ever lived, Stuart Hackett was so brilliant in his Resurrection of Theism. The whole first part of the book just critiques Kant. He says, here's a guy whose whole philosophy was built on the rejection of what's called the preformation theory, that the mind is preformed to fit reality, which is really what Aquinas believed. And Kant dismisses the whole thing in a couple pages, doesn't give any credence. He's got a 700-page book, his whole view rests on this, and he dismisses this in practically nothing. Aquinas would say to Kant, who are you to say that the categories, forms, empty to be sure, don't fit reality? How do you know the forms of your mind don't fit the forms of reality unless they do fit the forms of reality so that your mind can make some informative statements about reality? So all Aquinas' answer to this whole problem is very simple. You are born with certain forms or categories, empty to be sure, but innate, instinctive, natural, synderesis type categories. And even though you're not born with the law of non-contradiction already there as a stated proposition, an idea in your mind, you're born with a non-contradictory predisposition to. And therefore you can understand the principle when somebody spells it out because you know by way of inclination before you know by way of cognition. You know by way of your natural bend toward truth before you know when you're thinking about or cogitating about this truth. So he has the best of both worlds, innate inclination, but only sensible cognitions. Aquinas' solution is, I know first principles because God created me in his image as an intelligent being which can know reality, and by very nature, before I ever get any principles in my mind, I am built that way to know these principles when they come to my mind.
What if someone has different inclination than what we have been discussing, and the first principles would be different?
If you could prove.
When someone perceives reality not as being, but as becoming, which would alter the first principles that he might have, other than the law of identity or
if you could prove that, it would be a refutation of Aquinas. If you could prove that some people truly have a different inclination, an irreducible first principle, different inclination, without involving yourself in any self-falsifying, self-stultifying statements.
But then you're using the criteria which is based on your own first principles to adjudicate or to judge others
exactly right, because they are self-evident and undeniable. If he had a set of self-evident and undeniable principles, he could do the same thing. So if he can come up with a set of self-evident, undeniable first principles, which are the opposite, logically opposite of these, then we would be in an ultimate fideistic shouting match. Right? Because all I could do is stand on my self-evident first principles that I know being, and he'd stand on his, so you don't know being, you only know becoming. But see, what I say to him, let's take the two and show how it's not a shouting match. I know being. And with that, I also know that it's not non-being. That's all implied in the system. It's also a first principle. Here's somebody who says, I don't know being. I know becoming. Now, I think you can show that position two is self-defeating, that it has to borrow some of my first principles in order even to articulate its statement. It has to borrow, to make the statement, I don't know being, it has to borrow the premise that I do know being in order to even make that statement intelligible.
Wait, but there is a third other than the being. The third one would say, I know being, which is becoming.
Then I have to show that being and becoming are mutually exclusive statements.
Are they?
Well, I'd have to show that. If they aren't, then they would be identical, or the law of non-contradiction wouldn't apply, and we're back to a first principle. It's either being or becoming, but not both being and becoming at the same time in the same sense. That is not to say that you can't get a being that has something about it that is becoming, but it can't be essential to its being. It'd have to be accidental, like I am changing in size and shape and knowledge. That's accidental. But suppose you say, I, my very essence, is something and is not that at the same time in the same sense. And you'd have a contradiction, and the law of non-contradiction is undeniable or self-refuting. So if they affirm both of those and they mean something different, then you have a contradiction. And you're right back to arguing, does the law of non-contradiction apply to reality? And I would argue they can't use it here without borrowing it from here. They can't use it here without, they can't deny it here without using it in their statement there. Where I don't have to do that, in mine, my statement isn't self-defeating. I know being is self-evident, not self-defeating. Their statement, I don't know being, I only know becoming, is self-defeating and not self-evident.
Okay, if we said that, let's do two things. Let's answer your question both levels. Logic does not apply to all of reality. That's what one statement is, because reality is always bigger. What you have is logic does apply to this much of reality right here. Let's call that R1, but it doesn't apply to R2. And R1 usually turns out to be finite reality, and R2 turns out to be infinite reality, but it wouldn't matter. That boils down to saying that the laws of logic do not apply to, let's call it infinite reality or some kind of reality there. That's exactly what Van Til says, incidentally, and Duyvird, two notable Christian philosophers, that the laws of logic do not apply to God. They apply to finite reality, but ultimately don't apply to God. That very statement is self-defeating.
that the laws of logic don't apply to reality is an application of the laws of logic to that very reality of which you're saying it doesn't apply. So the statement becomes self-destructive.
How about the logic of causality?
Of what?
The causality. It applies only to